following program is recommended for mature individuals and may contain material unsuitable for morons, cretins, and dishwipes. If you are a moron or a member of the PTL Club, please turn off your radio, because we don't need any more stupid, narrow-minded, pencil-neck geeks who wouldn't know the First Amendment if it came up and bit them on the butt. Thank you.
Back. This is episode 3 of Chat with a Cat. In episode 2, I kind of promised to do a little bit of a division breakdown, and I put it off until we'd had a little bit of time with the regular season to see how things shake out. I think we've now had enough time. This is following the regular season Sim 3, and we're starting to see some trends emerge. We're starting to see some things shake out. And so I wanted to kind of jump in and go over division by division how I'm seeing things shake out. But before I do, I wanted to note one general trend, which I alluded to in episode 2 when we were looking at the preseason, and it continues into the regular season. If you take a look at what has happened in the regular season with home versus road splits, if you look right now, the home teams are currently winning 67% of all games, which means very early in the season, Sim 1 and Sim 2, it was a little bit difficult to tease out which teams were actually good and which teams' records reflected the fact that they had had a lot of home games to start the season. Now things are starting to even out. Teams have had roughly the same amount of games at home and on the road, and so we can see, I guess, more who's for real and who's not. So we're going to start in the Atlantic Division, where there is a real divide, a real separation coming into place. There are two teams that I think are looking very strong for slightly different reasons, and three teams that I think are problematic. And in fact, I would suggest that the Atlantic Division, it's probably already pretty clear who the playoff teams are. So at the top of the division, you have the New Jersey Nets, who are 14-7. In second place, you have the Boston Celtics, who are 13-8. They're followed by the Washington Bullets, who are 7-14. The New York Knicks are 5-14. And the Philadelphia 76ers, at least as of recording, are 2-17. And they're on a 10-game losing slide. And I'm going to actually start at the bottom and work my way up. So let's start with Philadelphia. And the reason I think Philadelphia is in trouble, the first thing that jumps out at me, other than the 10-game losing streak, is their point differential. Right now on the season, they're sitting at an average of negative 13.4 points per game. And then the second thing that jumps out just by looking at the standings page is their home record is 2-8. In a league where the average team wins 67% of their home games, posting a 2-8 home record is indicative that this isn't schedule-based. This is actually it's actually a talent issue, where it's not likely they're going to make a lot of wins this season. And I think I've alluded to it before. I think I can see where Digi Skunk was going with his team building here. If I take a look at his top six players, the only one that looks like they're currently in their prime maybe would be Kevin Grevy, their shooting guard. But everybody else, Gerald Henderson, Wes Matthews, Jerry Sichting, Mike Woodson, and Michael Thompson, they're all younger players that still have improving to do. They can grow into better players. So this season may be a little bit of a disappointment. I would assume that DigiSkunk hoped that he would be doing better. But there's hope for the future because this is a young team. They have room in their potentials to grow, and they'll have a high draft pick, it looks like, so they'll be able to build around that and improve their team. Digging a little bit deeper into their current strengths, they are the number 4 team in the league in terms of steals, and they're doing pretty good at not giving up steals. So right now they are second overall in terms of steal margin. So that's something to watch out for as the 76ers continue is, are they going to be able to continue to add players that can generate a lot of disruption in the passing lanes, that take care of the basketball, and as they start growing and cleaning up in other areas, that may become the strength of their team. I mentioned before that styles make fights, and at least early on, we can start seeing some of the pieces that are coming into place for the 76ers. One of their other, I mean, it's a relative strength, I guess, is their three-point shooting. Right now, they're seventh in the league in three-point shooting. The problem is they're shooting 29%. They're allowing 35%. So if they can tighten up that three-point defense, three-pointers and steals might be the things they hang their hat on in the future, which means this is looking like a perimeter-oriented team. So if I were DigiSkunk and I was looking at the draft, I'd probably be looking to add one more big man to go with Michael Thompson. Also, if you look at their size, outside of Michael Thompson, most of the players they're starting are 6'5 and smaller. So that might also speak to why they're having problems rebounding, why they're not shooting well, because they're having to shoot, you know, in a forest, why they're not able to block everybody else's shots because they're smaller players. So if I were trying to prescribe for DigiSkunk what I think he ought to be looking for in terms of drafting or free agency or trading, I think the Philadelphia 76ers need to find a way to add a big man. That doesn't mean they can't lean on their guard strengths, but I think they're going to need another big man before they're able to start stabilizing the ship. Next up is the New York Knicks. Again, the Knicks are 3-7 at home, and that was the thing that jumped out to me most for them. Their point differential is negative, but it's not horrifically so. But again, that home record of 3-7, again, in a league where the average is 67%, winning less than half of that is a problem. And so the thing you want to look at is, okay, what are their strengths? What are their weaknesses? And if you dive into what the Knicks have been doing, the Knicks are number 3 in the league in both offensive rebounding and three-point percentage, which is kind of a weird way to build your team, offensive rebounding and three-point percentage. It's hard to find players that are good at both, because usually offensive rebounders tend to be inside players and three-point shooters tend to be outside players. But on the other hand, it does make a little bit of sense. As we all know, three-pointers are worth more per basket than two-pointers, and since three-pointers are generally a lower percentage, there will be more offensive rebounds available. So that may be how the Knicks are trying to put their team together, is a lot of outside shooting, and then when they miss, getting more chances to rebound their own misses. Looking at their weaknesses as a team, one of the things that is, at least to me, pretty obvious is their defense. Obviously, they're 21st in the league in terms of opponents' points per game allowed. They're 21st in the league in terms of rebounds. They're 20th in the league in terms of opponents' field goal percentage. They're not that great themselves either, but I think that's probably because of the three-point heavy volume. And similar to what we saw with DigiSkunk's Philadelphia 76ers, the Knicks have a team that is built a lot around smaller players. Julius Erving is 6'6 at the small forward. They do have Bob Lanier and Dave Corzine, both 6'11 twin towers, which was probably what's powering their rebounding numbers. But they're also working with Erving. They've got Daryl Griffith at point guard. They've got Freeman Williams. They've got Billy Knight. These are all guys that are 6'4 and under. And so, again, size is a little bit of issue for the Knicks. I think it will be interesting to see, as they're looking in the draft, do they try to get bigger in the backcourt, or do they try to add a front court player, maybe try to slide Erving back? And then, of course, the other question is, how long is Lanier going to be able to play at a high level for this team? Now, he's not a key piece. He's only averaging 20 minutes a game, a little under 9 points and 5 rebounds a game. So they're not reliant on him, but he does seem to be one of their stronger players in terms of plus minus. So maybe they should be looking to utilize him a little bit more rather than going with the small ball lineups where Eddie Jordan is their third guard. So again, similar to Philadelphia, I think New York is probably in the hunt for a big man in the off season. I think just like Philadelphia, they have a surfeit of talent in the backcourt. Although, as we noted in the creation draft, yes, big men were talented and most teams could get one, but it's mostly at center. It's been hard to find power forwards that are effective. And so the market for power forwards is likely to be tight. But if I were the Knicks, I would try to stay the course and see what I can do in the draft over the next couple of years. Maybe get some of their players into the weight room and improve them that way. The third have-not team is the Washington Bullets. Now, Washington is 6-4 at home, which means they're playing about average at home, but they're 1-10 on the road. So they're a little bit below average on the road. And I think the reason for that can easily be seen if you take a look at their team statistics. They're 19th in the league in terms of point differential, and they're 22nd in the league in terms of drawing fouls and 18th in terms of committing fouls. But on a net, they're the worst team in the league in terms of foul differential. Which means their opponents are getting free points at the line, and that's probably the difference between what Washington is doing and where they'd like to be. And so one of the things that they're going to need to look at in the offseason is how to add some more bulk inside and maybe how to stay away from fouling. Now, the good news for them is they are a mostly young team. Some of the bad news is that two of their best players, Brad Davis and Michael Ray Richardson, already appear to be close to their potentials, and they're both a bit small at 6'5 and 6'3. So, again, this is another team where front court help is probably something they're going to be focusing on in the offseason. And so, with the entire Atlantic Division so far looking for front court help, we can see that, at least early on, the trend appears to be if you focused on your back court instead of your front court during the draft, maybe that's coming back to bite you a little bit, and so you're probably hoping for some good draft classes. Moving on into the Habs in the Atlantic Division, you've got the Boston Celtics. They're 7-4 at home, which is decent. Yeah, you'd expect them to have in 11 games either 6 or 7 wins if they're winning at the average rate. But they're 6-4 on the road, meaning they're doing about twice as well as you would normally expect. And I think probably the main reason for that is their 1-2 punch in the front court of Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and Elvin Hayes. If you look at their statistics, they are currently sitting at number 2 in the league in terms of block differential. They're number 1 in the league in terms of field goal percentage differential. They've got the second best field goal defense in the league, and they've got the second best adjusted field goal percentage defense in the league. So they're doing it on the strength of shutting people down on the inside. They're doing a good job of staying roughly even on the boards, which is kind of interesting. You would think between Abdul-Jabbar and Hayes, they'd have a pretty powerful presence on the backboards. The problem is they don't have a lot at the small forward, and they're very small in the backcourt. And so I think that's a point that they could look to shore up if they can bring in a good rebounding small forward. They probably don't need to do much with their backcourt because I think their backcourt has been affected. Or effective, rather. Calling back a little bit to my first comments on who I thought was taken too highly, and Maurice Cheeks, he is averaging just 11.7 points, but he is averaging 10.9 assists and 3 rebounds, which the 3 rebounds really surprises me. Maybe they're happy with that. I know I'd like to see a little more scoring out of Mo Cheeks, but he does have some room to grow yet in terms of his potentials. And I think the fact that they're able to lean on Hayes and Abdul-Jabbar for now, and then they can wait for Cheeks to grow into his potentials, probably means that Angry Banana is pretty happy with how this team has turned out so far. I think they have a chance to get some all-league points from Abdul-Jabbar. He may be an older player, and we all had the discussion about how far is he going to drop in the draft because of that. But he's looking good with 28.8 a game, almost 10 rebounds a game, almost 3 blocks a game. If memory serves, he's actually leading the league in blocked shots. Let me go double-check that. Nope, he's a tenth of a block behind George Johnson of New Jersey, who we'll cover in a minute. But I think if you were to tell Angry Banana that he'd be 13-8, Kareem would be averaging almost 30-10, he'd probably take that. The concern for Boston, of course, is they did do a little bit of win now with their front court. So, yes, they're great this season. How long is it going to last? I suspect that he would say that's a problem for next season. Right now, they're everybody else's problem this season, and that's fair enough. The one weakness that I see in this team is their free throw shooting. They are dead last in the league in free throw shooting. They're also dead last in free throw shooting differential. So if you get them into a free throw shooting contest, maybe that's a way to beat them. However, it is worth noting that they don't foul a lot more than their opponents. So it's not like that's something where a lot of teams are going to be able to beat them on the margins. So something to bear in mind as they go forward, especially in the playoffs when games are tight, how do they perform at the line in the clutch? It'll be interesting to keep an eye on that. Finally, we come to the New Jersey Nets. They're sitting atop the division at 14-7. They're 11-2 at home, which means they're doing a little bit better than normal. They're 3-5 on the road, which tells you, number one, they haven't had as many road games as the Celtics have by percentage. And with the Celtics doing so well, you wonder if over the long term, the Celtics are going to be able to catch and surpass the Nets. So I think the Atlantic Division is really a two-horse race, and it's going to come down a lot to how well each team is able to impose their will in the head-to-head matchups. Now, one of the things that I find interesting, and I touched on it briefly, is they have George Johnson playing at center, and he's leading the league in block shots at 2.9, but he's averaging just 7 points. What they do have, and I called this out as one of the players that I thought was one of the steals of the draft at power forward, is Daryl Dawkins. Dawkins is averaging an absurd 31 points and over 8 rebounds, and he's doing that on a mere 55% shooting. So the New Jersey Nets have a complete monster at power forward, and that's a position that most teams are weak in. So right there, that is your matchup problem, and if you match up with New Jersey in the playoffs, you are going to have to figure out how to deal with Dawkins. Between Dawkins and Johnson, they're number one in defensive rebounding. They're number one in blocks in the league. So this is a team that is really anchored by their two quality big men. They're also number one in the league in terms of avoiding fouls. And so you're not going to be able to get those big men into trouble. So I think it's going to be imperative on a lot of teams to figure out a way to get some jump shot and backcourt scoring where these two are not disrupting absolutely everything. And so that will be an interesting contrast of styles, because this is a team that is A, defensively heavy on the front court, but also uses a battering ram power forward. But they're also getting excellent production out of their wing players. Cliff Robinson is averaging 20 points a game and 10 rebounds a game. I'll be honest, I thought he was a couple of years away in the draft. So he has been a pleasant surprise for me in terms of watching his production. And then Larry Drew, I know T.R. Dunn is averaging 13.7, but Larry Drew averaging 13 points and 6 assists. Again, he's got the potential to do it. I didn't see him doing it this quickly, and I thought his 3 defensive rebounding rating would be a liability. But when the rest of your team is hoovering up rebounds, I guess, you know, that's okay, and they're making do with that. The one concern I would have if I were the Nets is their 2 starting guards, T.R. Dunn and Larry Drew, are shooting 40% and 34% respectively. So if I am a team trying to match up with them in the playoffs, I think I'm probably going to throw help defense at them. That should force the ball out of the hands of their big men and into the hands of their guards, and that gives me maybe the best chance of beating them. I certainly don't want to try to match up with Daryl Dawkins, because he's just going to shred anybody who's trying to guard him. The other thing with this team is, you know, Larry Drew is 22, Cliff Robinson is 20, Daryl Dawkins is 23. So with the exception of Johnson, who's 32, this is a young team with a lot of room for improvement. So I expect that we're going to see a lot of noise coming from RPF for a long time. New Jersey is very well set up, and I'm sure over the next couple of years he's going to be looking to cash in to pick up another center to replace Johnson as Johnson gets older. But again, you know, looks like a solid team, and they're going to be a problem. And who's going to win it between New Jersey and Boston? It's probably going to come down to how well New Jersey can keep up their rebounding with the help of Cliff Robinson versus whether Boston's front court is going to dominate. So as we've talked about several times in the league is kind of dominated on the inside right now, and that's very evident in the Atlantic Division, where the teams with strong front courts are leading the pack, and the teams with strong back courts but are a little bit weak up front are struggling. Moving on to the Central Division, there's only one real have-not in the Central. That's the Atlanta Hawks, who are currently sitting at 4-14. Probably hurt the most by the fact that they have an 0-11 record on the road. But their point differential is negative 13.2. That's on par with Philadelphia's negative 13.4 for worst in the league. And when you take a look at why, well, they're, if you look on their margins, they're almost last in the league in points. They're second to last in offensive rebounds, in rebounds generally. They're last in block shot differential. They're second to last in turnover differential. They're second to last in field goal shooting. So they don't shoot it well. They don't hang on to the ball. They don't rebound. They don't score. They're going to have some issues. Now, a lot like the Philadelphia 76ers, the good news for them is most of their core players are under 25 and have room to grow. Dennis Johnson is not over, or is not under 25. He's 26, but he also has room to grow. But you look at, you know, Mike Evans, he's still got room to improve. Purvis Short has room to improve. Vinnie Johnson has room to improve. So this is another team that is not really equipped to compete yet this year. They're probably a couple of years away. And again, continuing our theme from before, when you look at the bigs that they're starting Major Jones, who's averaging 8 points and 6 rebounds, and Ben Poquette, who's averaging 9 points and 7 rebounds. And in a conference where you've got several guys that are, you know, walking double-doubles, averaging 20, 30 points, that's just not enough. So again, Atlanta, I think, is set in their wings and in their guard position, but they're going to need to get bigger in the offseason. And so I expect that to be something that they're looking at, which means the top of the draft, at least so far from what we've seen, is probably going to be big men heavy. And fortunately for them, that does kind of match up a little bit with some of the better players at the top of this draft. Right now, the projected number one pick is Danny Ainge. Isaiah Thomas is projected at number 3. I think they could fall simply on the basis of the teams that will be drafting toward the top of the draft don't need help in the backcourt. They need help in the frontcourt. Moving on, we come to the Chicago Bulls, who are currently sitting at 11-11. They're 5-5 at home, 6-6 on the road. So they're a little better than expected on the road, a little worse than expected at home. But they're kind of right down the middle, which in this conference probably makes them a solid playoff team, or at least on the fringes of the playoffs. I have to get a little bit of a mea culpa here. I did call Michael Cooper my biggest disappointment in terms of how high he went, but he's been averaging 16.5 points on 52% shooting. I still don't know if he can maintain that for the season, but having a player that averages 16, 5, and 6 is certainly nothing to sneeze at. I just would have liked that to be my number 2 pick rather than my number 1 pick. Right now, they're being led by Edgar Jones at 17.2 points a game, and he's doing that on 56% shooting. So again, the Bulls are doing it mostly on the strength of their front court. Kyle Macy has been hurt, and so it's quite possible, you know, with him only playing in 3 games, once they get him back, they'll be able to rise in the standings a little bit. He put up 17 points per game before going down, and he's been down for most of the first couple of weeks of the season, so I'm sure they're happy to get him back. And Logan is going to be able to have his team at full strength. And if he keeps them there, I think they've got a pretty good shot at making the playoffs. This is probably the team that was hurt most by injuries early. And so as they get healthy, they'll have a chance to climb back up. The fourth place team in the Central is the Milwaukee Bucks, who are kind of on a losing streak. They started hot. And at one point, I think we're even leading the division, but I think that may have been a little bit of fool's gold, because if you look at their first few games, they featured a heavy slate of home games. Now that they're into an equally heavy slate of road games, they're starting to pick up losses. And the Milwaukee team, they don't have any ridiculously outstanding players, I don't think. Nobody jumps out at you as completely running away with things. I do think that Walter Davis was a good pickup for them. 23.3 points a game is respectable, but it's not, 30 points like some of the other players we've seen. So this looks like a team that's pretty well balanced. If I'm looking at their differentials, they are doing an excellent job on the offensive glass and with steals. They're not doing so great when it comes to block shots, and they're kind of middle of the road just about everywhere else except free throw percentage, where they make their free throws. So this is not a team that you want to put on the line, but a team that is right down the middle of the road in terms of productivity and in terms of margins is a team that will probably end up toward the bottom end of the playoffs. I do think that there's going to be kind of a three-way battle for the final playoff spot among Milwaukee, Chicago, and probably Detroit, and I'll get to them in a minute. I think the last spot in the Eastern Conference is going to be fought over for the playoffs, but I think we can already see Washington, New York, Philly, and Atlanta are probably out. New Jersey and Boston, the Atlantic, are in, and I think Indiana, and we'll go next to Cleveland in the Central, are in. The reason I think the reason I think Cleveland has a pretty good shot of getting in is they're sitting at 13-7, which is a 65% win percentage, but they played 12 games on the road where they've gone 7-5 and just 8 at home. So with a road heavy schedule, they're already keeping up with most of the other teams that would normally be in front of them. Also, they have one area where they're very, very good at, and that is offensive rebounds. They have the number one margin in the league. And in turnovers, they're number 5 in the league. So what that means is they are getting extra possessions versus their opponents, probably more than a lot of teams. And that's going to naturally lead them to having more opportunities to win. Now, this is the first team that we've reviewed that is a little bit backcourt heavy. In terms of their production, looking at their backcourt, Kenny Carr is averaging 19 points, Jim Paxson 21, Sidney Moncrief 22, and in the front court, only Rick Mahorn at 14.8 is averaging double digits. But what we're seeing with them is Moncrief is grabbing almost 6 rebounds a game, Kenny Carr is grabbing almost 9, so their backcourt is rebounding as well as a lot of front courts. And so that is why they are doing as well as they are, is going back to the first podcast that I talked about, finding players that are a little bit anomalous at their positions, and that allowed them to stack up on rebounding, which helps them generate extra possessions and do pretty well. One of the things that I would be a little bit worried about if I was in the Central is that most of their core players are still 25 and under. So this is another team that's set up pretty well for the long haul. The only real, I guess, weakness, need that they're looking for, and stop me if I sound like a broken record here, is they could probably use an upgrade at power forward at some point. Now, their current starting power forward is Joe Merriweather. He's 27. He's got some room to improve. So they're not in as great a need as everybody else, but I think if you were to ask what does Cleveland need more than anything else, I think the answer does wind up being power forward. And with so many teams needing power forwards, it does mean that it's going to be difficult, I think, for these teams to land the player that they're after. I think because of the way their road record looks and because of their balance early, I do think Cleveland may have gotten off to a bit of a slow start. And while I don't know that they'll be able to catch Indiana, who we'll get to for the division, I do think that they will probably be a very strong second as the league goes on. Moving ahead to the number two team currently in the Central, that's the Detroit Pistons. Now, they're 14-7 overall, but they're 10-3 at home, which is slightly better than normal, and 4-4 on the road. So their record may be a little bit inflated by the fact that they've played 13 games at home and only 8 on the road, and that's why I expect Cleveland to be able to catch up to them and maybe overtake them. This is a team, though, that has one of the players that I didn't mention in one of my previous podcasts, but that I have been watching that I really, really liked and wish he had fallen to us, and that's Dan Roundfield. He's a 27-year-old power forward, and right now he is averaging 28.7 points a game and basically, let's call it 10 rebounds a game. So in a league where power forward productivity is difficult to come by, the Detroit Pistons have it. They've also got Sven Nader at center, who is not setting the world on fire, but at 14 points and 9 rebounds himself, it means they've got a very strong front court. So this is a front court that theoretically can match up with some of the other beastly front courts in the East. They don't have quite the perimeter production. Ricky Green and Mike Newland are both averaging around 15 points a game. So that may be something that winds up costing them a playoff series down the line. But if you look at, you know, again, I'm kind of watching margins here. They're second in scoring margin. Their defense is solid. They're number 6 overall in the league. They're excellent at their free throw shooting in terms of margin. The one concern there is that they're only 12th in the league overall, which is probably more reflective of who they played when it comes to margin, because generally there's not a lot of defense at the foul line that you can play. But they're very good at defending. There's no glaring weaknesses in the team. Like, their worst attribute is they're 14th out of 23 teams, so just under average in blocks, and they're 12th in steals. But everywhere else, they're in the upper echelon of the league. So they're getting enough out of their backcourt to supplement their front court. Marcus Johnson has been doing a good job. He hasn't been leading them in scoring. That's been Roundfield, but he's giving them an overall well-rounded attack with 21 points, almost 7 boards, over 5 assists, over a steal. Again, this is a team that's well-rounded. They're maybe a little bit older in spots. Nader's 30, Roundfield is 27, Mike Newland, their guard, is 31, Ricky Green's 26. And they may drop a little bit with the injury to Green. He's out for another 6 weeks. But I think once they get him back, because of the injury to Green, I don't think they're going to be able to catch Indiana, but I think they will challenge for number two in the division and probably be in the mix for they should be in the mix for a playoff spot. They might even be in the mix for home court advantage. Finally, we'll talk about the Indiana Pacers. They're currently number one overall in the league in terms of scoring margin. Their weakness, such as it is they're not a great passing team. But this was an isolation era of basketball. Really, the motion offenses that you see today were not something that was in vogue in the early 80s. So I think seeing more players that are strong in isolation is fine. And they are being led by a player that I didn't want to mention much, but now I kind of have to. I was hoping he'd fall to me in the draft, honestly. But and I've already mentioned this to Paulie, he knows. But Adrian Dantley is just absolutely destroying fools from the shooting guard spot. He's averaging 31.5 points a game, and he's doing it on 54% shooting and 86% shooting from the line. So that is their number one matchup problem. But they've got a magnificent complimentary punch in Joe Barry Carroll. I think a lot of people hear Joe Barry Carroll and they equate him to Sam Bowie. Sam Bowie was the number two pick in the 84 draft behind Michael Jordan. And most people say he was a bust, mostly because medical issues with his feet hampered his career. Joe Barry Carroll was the second overall pick to Magic Johnson, if memory serves. The difference is Joe Barry Carroll was a multiple-time All-Star. He's a fantastic offensive player, and we can see that in the Pacers where he's going for 25-7 already, and he's only 22 years old. So the Pacers have a terrific 1-2 punch there. And then the one player that, at least to me, has been surprising, and at least right now is probably the leader in the clubhouse for Sixth Man of the Year, is their point guard, James Silas. He's doing double duty at both guard slots for 30 minutes a game off the bench, and he's averaging 21 points a game. So you have a monstrous player on the wing in Dantley, you have a terrific center, and you have a great combo guard off the bench. And then, you know, the rest of their team is solid. They don't have any natural weaknesses. And the other thing that I would worry about if I were some of the other teams with Indiana is if you take a look at their opponent's foul differential, they're number two in the league because Dantley and Carroll both draw a lot of fouls, which means they're getting your best players into foul trouble. They're getting a lot of free points at the line, especially because Joe Barry Carroll shoots terrifically from the line. He's a 79%er from the line. I mentioned earlier, Dantley is an 86%er. And oh, by the way, James Silas gets to the line a lot too, and he's only a 90% shooter. So this is a team that is currently number one in the league in scoring margin. And I would wager nearly all of that is coming from living at the free throw line. They're getting almost seven more free throws a game, and collectively they shoot like 80% from the foul line. So right there, you're looking at a bonus 5.5-6 points a game just from the foul line. So Indiana is going to be a very tough matchup. I fully expect them to be in the running for the top overall seed in the league, and certainly the top overall seed in the East. They may wind up losing it due to injury, but at least right now they're out to a 7-4 start. They're the only team in the East that's undefeated at home, and they're 8-4 on the road. So they're even winning a huge number of games on the road. In fact, it's the best road record in the league, much less in the East. So if you really want to see who the best teams are, watch their road record and watch their point differential, and they're number one in both. So right now, Indiana, to me, is the clubhouse leader in terms of whom I expect to see coming out of the East in the playoffs, barring injury. I'm going to hold off on the West, partly because I'm in it, and it's probably less interesting for me to talk about my team, and partly because right now, the West is super bunched up. The San Antonio Spurs have separated themselves a little bit from the pack, and the Kansas City Kings are kind of down in the bottom. but everybody else is clumped so closely together. I'm gonna punt for a week and let's see another few Sims worth of games and see if anybody separates themselves or if we are gonna have a nasty bruising conference all the way down to the wire. I think, you know, basically every team but Kansas City is still right there. San Antonio has a tiny lead. But, you know, again, if you look at the number of home games they played versus road games they played 12 at home, they played 7 on the road. Once that starts evening out, they could very well fall right back to the pack. So let's give that one a little more time. We'll watch the West, and I guess that'll be the next podcast. We'll be taking a look at what's going on in the West. This has been Chat with a Cat, and with that, I'm going to wrap things up.